My name is Chris Brennan, and you're listening to the Astrology Podcast. This episode is recorded on Tuesday, August 23rd, 2016, starting just after 3:23 p.m. in Denver, Colorado, and this is the 87th episode of the show. For more information about how to subscribe to the podcast and help support the production of future episodes by becoming a patron, please visit theastrologypodcast.com/subscribe. In this episode, I'm going to be talking with Austin Kopic and Kelly Surtees about the astrological forecast for September of 2016, as well as some auspicious dates for beginning new ventures and undertakings using the principles of electional astrology. So Kelly and Austin, welcome back to the show.
Hey, guys.
Hi.
Hey, all right. It's been exactly 1 month, actually, since we recorded our last episode. I think I wrote down it was July 24th, so time really flies by. How have you guys been doing?
Keeping busy. August has been very full, lots of travel for work and for pleasure. So I'm kind of looking forward to September. I know there's a few changes planet-wise. But I'll be looking forward to being home and getting back into a bit of a routine.
Awesome. And you're actually getting ready to go on another trip tomorrow, right?
Yes. My amazing August full of adventure is not over yet. I will be flying out to Seattle tomorrow and teaching a 3-day program with Laura Nalbandian and Kira Sutherland on the moon this weekend. So that's really exciting.
Nice. Cool. And Austin, what have you been up to?
Oh, let's see. I've been writing and reading and teaching, and I did do a little bit of traveling, a little bit more than I'd planned on. We did some traveling to meet family, to meet up with family. Just kind of doing my thing. Writing awesome. About astrology, going to Kung Fu. You know how it is.
I still see you cranking out the weekly columns. It seems like you've gotten a good rhythm down on that.
Yeah. I wrote for 8 years straight, but then I took a 3-year break and I just got back into it this January. And, it was very difficult the first several months, but I feel like I've gotten a better handle on it. I've let go of every week being, some sort of perfect immortal, gem.
Right. Yeah, that's always the hardest thing I'm definitely finding in my own writing is like when it's good enough or when is enough is enough to let it go and just put it out there instead of trying to make something that's like immaculate or perfect.
Yeah, and I think that, and Kelly would, I imagine, agree with me here, that when you're doing material that expires, you really have to think about that. Because if you spend 20 hours on a column that's going to be obsolete in a week, you're bleeding other parts of your life dry.
Right.
100%.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That's actually always been one of the hesitations. That's why I put off doing even something like this for so long, because of that whole thing of expiring, of writing something or putting a lot of energy into something that only has a very short sort of shelf life. But I've sort of developed a better appreciation for that over the past year as we've been doing these shows, even though it's still something, that sometimes you have to like really think about how much energy do you want to put into this before moving on. So in that spirit, we're going to be kind of winging it today with our September forecast. I think people really liked the format, the sort of looser format of the last time we did this for the forecast for August. So we'll be giving it another shot again. In terms of announcements before we get started, so recently I put up a bunch of people who keep asking me for like a donation page or why there isn't like a tip jar or something on the podcast website, for those that are hesitant to sort of sign up for a regular Patreon thing or can't or for whatever reason. So, I actually put up a donation page. If you go to theastrologypodcast.com/donate. So there's two things. One of them, there's just a little tip jar link where you can send me a tip or a donation through PayPal, which is pretty cool. And, the second is, I still need a bunch of books and stuff for citations for the book that I'm working on. I'm actually about halfway through filling in all my citations and footnotes, but I keep finding all these other sources that I don't have or that I checked out from the library, but had to send back. So I actually put up a link to my Amazon wish list. If you are a fan of the podcast and you want to support the book writing effort or just show your appreciation. And you can buy me a book and they'll ship it directly to my address if you purchase it off that list. So that's a cool sort of little thing. In terms of other announcements, this is the first and probably last episode of September because I'm still focused on writing and I lost a couple of weeks due to getting some strange mystery cold that took me down for a while. But this is the first of four episodes in the current round of giveaway prizes. And as I believe I announced on the last episode, this month, the giveaway prizes are going to be for the $5 tier, a free pass to my Introduction to Electional Astrology course. And for the people on the Patreon $10 tier, a free pass to my full online course on Hellenistic astrology. So all you have to do to become to get entered into the drawing is become a patron on the $5 or $10 tier. And then I'll announce the winner of the drawing on, three episodes from now? So episode 90. Since for the giveaways, we always do it sort of in four episode blocks. So that's it for announcements. I'm in the process of one other thing. I'm in the process of trying to finalize the design for my book cover. And I'm in the process of hiring different designers and having different people test out different things. So that has actually turned out to be in some ways more expensive than I expected because I started contacting. Have you guys ever, you know, hired somebody for a book cover or gone through that process?
I had someone organize a cover for my Saturn and Sag ebook, and I'd have to check with her exactly how she did it. But I think she used like an online platform where people pitch for the work. And it was very, very affordable from what I understood, a lot cheaper than some of the numbers you were throwing about earlier.
Okay.
Yeah, I can find the info out for you if you like.
Yeah, I'd be curious about that just because I'm sending out and some of the quotes I'm getting are like $500 or 500 pounds, which is actually like $600 or $700 for some professional sort of like high level book cover designers. So I'm starting to talk with some of them, and there's also been some people that have been very gracious in contacting me and sending me some preliminary book cover designs that have looked really good. But that's pretty much any donations that are sent through to the podcast this month or people that sign up to my courses this month, that money will be going towards trying to come up with some different book cover designs so that I can finally settle on one. But I will be transitioning into the sort of editing and design phase pretty soon, which is pretty exciting. And if there's any professional designers out there that want to sort of try to do a remix or rendition of the current sort of preliminary cover I have, then just send me an email and I can send you the files. And if I like it or if I end up selecting it out of all the possible options, then of course, I would pay you a decent fee and you would get acknowledgements in the book for having done the cover. So that's where I'm at this point. Trying to think of where we should get started. Do you guys have any other announcements about things that you have going on right now? I think you had something, right, Kelly?
Oh, yeah. Just two new things, I guess. My next online class, which is called Level 5, but basically we'll be focusing on relationships, is starting early in September. So if anyone's interested to join that, we've got room for a couple of new people to join the group. It's a 6-week online class. As long as you have an understanding of aspects or at least some familiarity with it, and perhaps a basic understanding of transits and progressions, you'll be able to pick up and move through the class. And I've just recorded a very special one-off Jupiter and Libra through the houses lecture that'll be made available for purchase probably early next week. So there's a couple of things to look out for if anyone's interested. Yeah, thanks.
Awesome. Good timing on that. And Austin, do you have anything coming up or just focusing on the column really right now?
No, I'm always doing 5 or 7 things. Right. So I'm starting a new 4-week module in my basics class, actually on the 27th of August. I don't know if the podcast will be out by then, but this is the unit where I go through traditional ideas about dignity. So we're going to go through the 5 layers of essential dignity deal with the idea of accidental dignity, talk about, you know, how sect relates to dignity. It's a pretty important class. You know, dignity is sort of a missing piece in a lot of people's astrology. And even when people begin to integrate it, a lot of times they're not sure exactly what to do with it. You know, it doesn't just make a planet, it doesn't just make your life awesome. If a planet's dignified, it doesn't necessarily mean your life is crap if a planet doesn't have traditional dignity. So we'll be kind of juxtaposing the theory and then what that looks like and what to look for. So that starts on Saturday, August 27th, and I still have room in that class for people. And then I haven't decided exactly when, but sometime in either early or the middle of September, I'm going to be doing just a one-off class, like maybe a two-hour lecture on planetary hours, planetary days and hours. Planetary days and hours end up coming up a lot in a variety of things that I teach. And I feel like I never have time within the class structure to really dig into it. I'm kind of like, yeah, this is how it works. And then there's a calculator. But I really like what I want to do with this is really dig in to how planetary days and hours work. Look at how long they've been part of astrology. Also look at how long they've been part of and a crucial part of a lot of magical traditions. And I also want to introduce a variant of planetary hours, which I picked up through Banati, where you have planetary days and planetary nights. So just this, you know, it's this piece of a lot of classes that I felt never got enough time. So I'm just going to do a one-off. And so that'll be a single meeting class in a sense.
That's actually something I've been trying to decide because I'm at the phase where I have to figure out, you know, what to keep in the book and what is not like non-essential and what I need to like cut from the book. And planetary days and hours was one of those things that I thought was really interesting, but doesn't get mentioned as frequently, even though it originated in the Hellenistic tradition. It doesn't come up as often as you would think. But that was connected with another research project that I was doing about sort of Jewish views on astrology during the Greco-Roman period, because I think the planetary days and hours, and correct me if I'm wrong, first show up in Jewish sources, right?
Well, they're it's in Valens.
Right. I know he's one of the earliest, but it's like there's some sort of, he's the earliest actual astrologer that mentions them, but there's some like pre-existing in terms of the days of the week. I was under the impression that there was like a first century source or something.
Oh, well, that's we're pretty sure that that's much older and Mesopotamian. And the Egyptians had methods for dividing the hours of night and day way, way, way. So the really planetary days and hours are anchored in, you know, what sometimes gets called proto-astrology. They're certainly way older. You know, it's some of the material that was synthesized and found a place or didn't in the, you know, the horoscopic astrology revolution, right?
Right.
But,
sure.
The Jewish opinion, I think, is something that actually ended up influencing Banati. So Banati's idea of planetary nights. So the idea is that the first hour with planetary days is the planetary hour, which begins the day at sunrise, defines the tenor of the entire day, right? That's where you get Monday, Moon Day, Tuesday, Mars Day, Wednesday, Mercury Day, et cetera, et cetera. But what Banati proposes, and this is a system I've been working with for, I don't know, 4 years now and have a lot of good experiences with. Is that the hour which begins the night also defines the night. And so day and night are given equal precedence. And that's connected, I believe. I need to follow up on my research for this before I do my class, with the Jewish doctrine of the dusk ending and beginning rather than dawn ending and beginning things. Mm. And so I think that by the time Banati gets to it, that's an alternate schema or a balanced schema. And I like that. I like that because it seems to work really well, but I also like that on a conceptual level because it, it partakes of this balance between night and day, and it makes the part of me that uses sect very happy.
Right. Yeah, which is something that otherwise seems like it gets sort of dropped or like falls out of the tradition the further you go. And it's interesting to see it almost being reasserted in that doctrine at that time.
Yeah, yeah. As I think we've all noticed with sect, it's so fundamental, the difference between night and day. It's night and day. it's so obvious that it's easy to overlook, right? You want to look at people, we get interested in like long-term synodic cycles and the movement of Jupiter-Saturn conjunctions through the triplicities over hundreds of years. It's like, well, what about night and day? Let's start with that.
Start with the basics.
Yeah. And sort of roughly connected with this, I've been, since the last episode I did, which was the one where I talked about Saturn as possibly conceptualized by some early astrologers like Dorotheus as potentially a feminine planet. That was actually, I guess, the last episode I did. And a lot of people, like several different people, all pointed out that Saturn in the Tree of Life is on the feminine sort of pillar or tier, right?
No. So there's a pillar of mercy and a pillar of severity. It's on the pillar, but those aren't masculine or feminine. Well, not primarily. It's on the pillar of severity, obviously, but it's in a sphere, Bina, which is considered to be feminine. And so when they look at, there are sort of god forms and names associated with each sphere. And those associated with Bina, which is Saturn's sphere, are almost uniformly feminine.
Okay. So that's interesting to me because that's the only, I've been looking everywhere for any other ancient parallel that would treat Saturn as feminine, because most of the other sort of like Greco-Roman traditions or even the earlier Mesopotamian traditions largely seem to treat it as masculine. And so I was trying to figure out if that one reference to Saturn as feminine Dorotheus was just like a textual error or whether there could be some other tradition that was influencing him. And this is one of the only ones that maybe it was sort of suggestive, but then the process of trying to figure that out is then the next question is, how old then is the Tree of Life? And also more specifically, how old are the specific planetary associations in the Tree of Life? And that's been a little bit challenging because it looks like the oldest, there's some general agreement. Well, there's a lot of debate actually about how old the Sefer Yetzirah is, but that some of the underlying concepts may go back to or be influenced by things that were happening already in the first and second and especially third and fourth centuries. So
the case for that is extremely strong. I mean, the mapping of the planets onto the Tree of Life is basically the Ptolemaic universe mapped onto the Tree of Life. Mapped onto the numbers 1 through 10.
But then, the problem I have is that the actual text that we have of the first like recensions of this text only date to the 10th century. And there's a question, because then that means that the text only dates to then, and that means, so the question then is where, what's the earliest reference to the planets being associated with this that can be found? Versus, because that's one thing versus like inferring, whether it was underlying the whole structure from the very start. So that's something I'm trying to figure out right now, but it's a little bit tricky.
Yeah. If I had to put money on it, I would say it happened during that Hellenistic Roman span. One of the problems with doing textual sources for what are obviously highly secretive traditions is that the relationship between textual proof and the reality and history of practice, that gap is really wide when you know you've got something that was intentionally hidden and was intentionally not public. It's one thing like if you're looking for the history of popular entertainment, right? Because the first time it shows up, that's when it showed up. Whereas there's always this big question mark. Well, this is when somebody first published something. But a lot of esoteric traditions, were primarily oral for a long time because that's a way of keeping secrets. And so there's that gap, which is, frustrating if you want to pin it to an exact date.
Right. I guess I'm wary about that to some extent, though, because then sometimes that argument's used in this opposite extreme, especially with some people that have worked with the Hellenistic material recently, to say that, you know, everything's esoteric, or that you have to read between the lines on everything, and there's all these hidden meanings, you know, in everything, so that sometimes that gets exploited to this sort of ambiguity of, you know, did they mean something else by this, or were there other implications, is then exploited to create all these like really elaborate doctrines that may never have existed. And so I'm always trying to balance between those two in terms of like recognizing there was some oral tradition and that was part of an esoteric tradition that sometimes employed, you know, secrecy or, you know, hidden numbering schemes or other things like that. But then on the other hand, also realizing that some of these texts are actually, you know, purely instructional, and we're receiving texts that perhaps, you know, weren't supposed to be shared outside of the schools that they were in, like with Valens's text. But otherwise, he's actually trying very hard to explicate the doctrines and be very clear what he's doing, because he's writing them for his students. But yeah, I understand that with something like this, you're talking about like a mystical Pythagorean sort of doctrine that is a little bit different.
Yeah, it is different. It was intentional, you know, in traditional Kabbalah, like you weren't even supposed to start training in it until, what I've read is that you were not supposed to start even bothering with it until you were 40. You know, it's like there were lots of filters on who could practice and learn and why. But, you know, just because you don't have it carved in stone or carved in paper at some point, doesn't mean that there's no difference between good and likely arguments and like sloppy arguments. You know, one, were there Jews in Alexandria when astrology was hopping? Yes. You know, when would they have seen that scheme of the planets? Because the planets are hung on the Tree of Life in Ptolemaic order, you know, in the order of the ascending and descending spheres. And then once you get beyond Saturn, then you have the sphere of the fixed stars and all that. It's, you know, it's that framework. And so we know that there were, you know, Jewish scholars and practitioners in the same place as astrology at the same time. They would have read those books. They would have gotten that. So if we're looking for a place where that connection would have happened, that's extremely likely. We don't know 100%. That's a reasonable guess, rather than be like, well, it was actually in 10,000 BC, you know, right, when Moses, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. All right. Well, that was just a little digression, because that's what I was doing this morning, was like trying to figure out when this text was written and when the planetary assignments are first mentioned and all of that, and some of the trickiness. So that's the type of stuff that I've been doing for the past month still, as I fill in citations and try and finish the book.
So one more note on that, just back to the Saturn Bina thing. Now Bina is seen as feminine, right? There's also a lot of times with Bina, you get oceanic imagery. There's a lot of marine imagery associated with Bina. And although that's not part of contemporary practice, you know that in really almost all of sort of pre-modern astrology, when you read Saturn delineations, there's all this ocean stuff, right? Like, oh, Saturn rules your 10th. You'll work by a river, or Saturn rules your 8th. You know, you will drown in a ship. Right. And so that's another, if we're looking at the Tree of Life and the sphere associated with the planet, that's another pretty strong linkage.
Yeah. The aquatic, like seafaring, especially themes with Saturn, were huge in the ancient traditions. And that was one of the reasons, I mean, they said that, you know, there was that whole myth surrounding Berossus and the idea that when all of the planets were aligned in Cancer, that the world would be destroyed by a fire. And when they were all aligned in Capricorn, that it would be destroyed by a flood. That sort of ties back into some of those themes as well. But in terms of just the masculine and feminine thing, it's such a, you know, it's a touchy issue for certain reasons, but then it's like a historical issue and all these things. I mean, do you guys use masculine and feminine, or have you found useful applications for it? I know, Kelly, you've done a lot of work with temperament theory. Would that affect things, or would that change things significantly in terms of that if you started conceptualizing Saturn as feminine, or do you already, or how do you feel about that whole thing?
Yeah, look, it's interesting because I don't think the main qualities like the hot, cold, wet or dry, I don't think they have a masculine or a feminine necessarily, perhaps in the way we might think about them as moderns, but they would certainly have a yin or a yang tone to sort of borrow from sort of Chinese or Eastern ideas. So Saturn as a cold and dry kind of combination, it would be incredibly yin. And yin is often associated with a more feminine, not female, but a feminine style, which is more introspective or more thoughtful or even more internal versus the yang of, say, like Mars or the Sun, which is much more extroverted, much more expressive, much more outwardly focused. So I can see certainly from that perhaps quality or core features perspective that there would be an argument for Saturn. I mean, I think yin energy can be male or female. You know, you can have men that are more yin in their type or expression. So it's really getting in some ways to semantics about word choice. But I think as long as people understand we're talking about the underlying energy or quality, there's definitely more of that yin tone to Saturn for sure.
I mean, is that something that you're not hesitant about, but that you have specific, that you prefer to conceptualize it more in that, in using those terms of yin and yang rather than masculine or feminine because of the, you know, other sort of gender associations or other implications that that might have that one might object to sort of philosophically or like socially in applying those qualities?
Yeah, it's a really good point. I think, look, for the most part, I probably do qualify Saturn as more masculine. I'm just trying to think if I was doing a horary and someone showed up with a Saturn significator, I'd be more inclined to think it was an older male. But on the same token, I don't know that I'd be surprised if it turned out to be an older female. I think the quality of the older. And I think actually, now that we're sort of thinking about it and I'm reflecting on it, sometimes the gender association is, it's almost a little bit like, I don't want to cause a big upset or upset people, but it's almost a little bit more like a modern / sun sign approach to it. It's just easy sometimes to say something's a bit more male / masculine or female / feminine rather than to go into the core themes as to what that's really alluding to or what you're really trying to say with that. Right. So I think the idea of putting these concepts of Saturn as potentially feminine out there is really tapping more into the core quality of how Saturn operates.
Sure. Yeah. Just trying to describe the nature of the archetype in some sense, using keywords that are naturally going to be imprecise or not fully representative. But then, you know, in some traditional models, I mean, one of the, you know, I spent like a lot of time working on this month in the book because I'm trying to explain it, but I'm always in this book because it's on the one hand like historical and I'm trying to do a survey of Hellenistic astrology and where these ideas and techniques come from. But then on the other hand, I'm also trying to show how it might be used still in a practical context or how it was used and the way in which it might still be used if one chose to do so is that sometimes they'd use it for very literal things in at least in like the first and second century, where if somebody wanted to know, you know, am I going to have, you know, male babies or feminine babies, that there would be this technique which you could use to potentially determine that. Or if you wanted to know the gender of somebody's siblings for whatever reason, that there could be a you know, measurement to look at that would indicate this. And so sometimes it's for like very literal things. And in that context, I feel like it's less hard to like object to that on sort of like moral or sort of social grounds.
I would just add, you know, Kelly brought up a horary, and I think that horary really frames it. Like, who stole my book?
Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, and a lot of the traditional techniques are like, okay, the signifier is Mars. All right. It's probably a young man. Right. Versus like, oh, the signifier is Jupiter. Oh, it was that wealthy book collector who said he just wanted to look at it for a little bit.
Right.
I would say that I've seen Saturn. I think a lot of people would agree with this, is that Saturn is not a terribly gendered planet.
That's actually a really good point, Austin.
Like, it can, you know, I think old people is a pretty safe bet with Saturn. But, and the idea of course, you know, being elderly is that generally speaking, especially before the advent of Viagra, there was less, gendered personality expression, and there was less physical, sexual expression as well, right? Like that we kind of neutral out as we get into our 70s and 80s. And I think that there,
that's sort a beautiful of, point.
And I would just add to that in the, kind of sideways, in the Chinese astrology, Saturn is associated with centering energy or depolarized energy, whereas the other planets are like lesser and a greater yin and lesser and greater yang, whereas Saturn is thought to be a centering or depolarizing sort of energy. And I think I would say that old age depolarizes us all. Now that I'm 37, I get it.
Yeah, sure.
So old, Austin.
Yeah. In the Indian tradition, going along with that, they actually evidently treat Saturn like Mercury in terms of being gender neutral. So it's interesting that you say that. So
yeah. Anyway, we could probably keep banging on about this, Chris. But
yeah, and this is, I know, a topic I'm going to come back to. So maybe I shouldn't spend the whole show talking about it. But all right, so let's move on to the astrological alignments. So. First, before we get into September, maybe we should do a little recap, or if there's any major news events from the past month that are worth mentioning, or looking back at previous forecasts we made or cycles that we're finishing up. Is there anything like that before we get into the future?
Yeah, I've got a few things. Two of them are not very nice, so I'll just get on with it. So... No, I don't want to. I don't know if I want to talk. I'm going to talk about the one thing that's not as awful.
Okay.
Cool. So real quick, the two awful things, the recapture of Fallujah, which started on the Mars conjunct full moon back in May and commenced on and basically finished up on the next full moon in Sag in June, right around the direct station, has just recently been revealed to be far bloodier than anyone thought. And there were a lot of civilian casualties. Yada, yada, yada. We said that would probably happen. It happened. That sucks. Let's move on. And then the other bad thing that I'm not going to dwell on, but significant for watching the Mars cycle, is the Philippines got a new president about 2 months ago, and he started this crazy crackdown, this war on drugs, which is currently killing, where they're killing about 36 people a day with very little due process. And so that was like, you know, right after the direct station of Mars and Scorpio, very unpleasant. And let's move on. The thing that I think is actually more illustrative of the Mars cycle that is violent, but more entertainingly so and intentionally so, is there's a pair of fighters in mixed martial arts who've been fighting in the UFC that had this match. I think it was the first day that Mars went into Sag. It was an early... when it was deep in the shadow in early March. And it's this guy, Conor McGregor, who's this, how should we say, face punching Irishman. I think he'd won 15 fights in a row, 11 of them by knockout. And he was the champion of the featherweight division. And he thought that he would come, he decided to come up 25 pounds in a weight class and then take a fight there. Cause he's just said, you know, there's nobody who can challenge me here. And he ended up fighting a guy named Nate Diaz, who took the fight with only 11 days to prepare. And McGregor was this massive favorite. I think the Vegas odds had him like 3 or 4 to 1. And Diaz knocked him down and choked him out. And it was just the biggest upset of all time. Right. But so this is like Mars, you know, getting, you know, moving into the area that he's going to come back through. Right. So they set up a rematch. And then right around, it was right in the, I think it was right on the Sun Mars opposition, which is the middle of the Mars retrograde cycle. McGregor starts saying that he's retired. He's not going to take the fight. And just acting up and creating a big media circus. So there's this big thing. They're like, no, I'm not going to fight, right? Mars, classic Mars Retro. But also classic Mars Retro, he says, yeah, actually, I am going to take the fight. And so the rematch actually happened just a few days ago on Saturday the 20th. And it's, you know, it was a Mars Saturn throwdown. A lot of people are saying it was the best fight in mixed martial arts history, or it was the best fight in 20 years. It went the full round, went the full time, which is 25 5-minute rounds or 25 straight minutes of these guys just pounding on each other. And it was really interesting to watch for me, because we have birth time for Connor. We don't have a birth time for Nate Diaz, but it was Mars at zero Aries, versus Mars in Taurus on the north node near Algol. And so, of course, Mars in Aries just runs in and throws bombs and then gets tired at the end of the second round. And Mars in Taurus doesn't wake up until the end of the second round. You know, it's funny, just ignoring a lot of other things, just looking at Mars with fighters is really interesting. But McGregor managed to win a slim decision over Nate Diaz. And now everybody says, oh, there's got to be a third fight. Right. So if we talk about Mars and we talk about retrogrades and things needing to be done three times in order to actually be finished. You know, we have this huge, well promoted, incredibly well attended fight, you know, where you had one and then two and everybody wants three. So I thought that was pretty interesting. And of course, what was interesting is I threw a horary on this. I haven't done horary to see who would win a fight before, but I thought it'd be worth an experiment. And what's interesting is McGregor's signifier ended up being Mars, which makes sense. He's extremely aggressive and has red hair, right? So if you want a Mars, you know, yes. If you want a Mars avatar, and so his signifier was conjunct Saturn, right? And I was like, oh, that's bad, but Saturn was the ruler of the 10th house, right? So the 10th house is victory in this case. And so not only did his signifier being conjunct the ruler of the 10th describe his victory, it also described the type of victory, where he had to do 25 grueling minutes and won in a very close decision, right? That's a Saturn victory. Like people say he went in there and he had to grind it out. Right. Yes. And that's a Saturn victory, is grinding it out. And what's interesting, somebody pointed this out to me, I don't remember who, but that Nate Diaz, he has a lot of scar tissue on his face. And so, you know, this is the guy with Mars a couple degrees off Algol. And so his face was just totally like he was red faced with blood from like round two onward. And so you have the Mars Algol guy with like the bloody head. Right. And if you think about Algol is literally the demon's head, right? And what's interesting about this Mars and Taurus guy with it on Algol is that he is impossible to knock out. You said, like, if you watch that fight, he took 10 punches that would have given a normal person brain damage, and he barely notices. Even in the replays, like, you see him like kind of like react for maybe an eighth of a second. And then he's just back to staring at the opponent. Literally, he's punched in the face and is flying through the air. And he's just watching the opponent and lands perfectly calm.
Mm. Wow.
So anyway, I thought that was, you know, it's pretty neat. Mars Saturn thing. So, yeah, you know, although
that's interesting also because, I was just seeing another news story recently, or just saw people referring to her, but it reminds me of, you know, Ronda Rousey, who is born in the same time frame and also had Saturn in Sagittarius. And we saw her, you know, take that huge fall from grace late last year. And she also has Saturn in Sagittarius and Mars in Aries.
So Connor's an 88 baby. So he also has Saturn in Sag.
Right. Yeah. So he's going through his Saturn return. And there was sort of a similar thing, except she hasn't sort of made a comeback at this point.
We're all kind of waiting on her.
Yeah, it sounded like that was actually one of the follow-ups that we never did, is just it sounded like she was in a pretty bad place. And she said on one interview that after losing that fight and becoming sort of disgraced, that she, you know, became suicidal at one point and was going through a really hard time. So she's getting the, like, you know, really tough version of the Saturn return. And the context in which I saw her referenced like last week was just people sort of hating on her because she was so built up for such a long time. And she was saying, you know, I could fight, you know, she was saying she could fight outside of her weight class and that she could take on.
What's funny is that Conor McGregor has a very parallel storyline. Mm. And they're both Mars and Aries.
Right.
And yeah, and they both have incredibly aggressive, I'm just going to run up to you and win styles. Like, she has a lot of first round, you know, Mars and Aries first round victory. And, McGregor, of you know, course. McGregor, his title fight, his first title fight a while back, was supposed to be this big deal. And he just ran up and knocked the guy out in 13 seconds. And so it was what everybody loved about this Diaz fight, this fight with Nate Diaz, is you can run up and punch Nate Diaz in the face. And he might wake up or he might stay sleepy for a while. You know, it's this like totally fixed Mars and Taurus that's just going to keep coming and, you know, might get excited at some point, but it might not be until the second or third round. And it's such a contrast to the Mars and Aries.
Right. That's such a great study in the quadruplicities or modalities, because that was another section of the book I was working on this past month, was just going back to that and what ancient authors say about that distinction, how they conceptualized it. And it's really just literal, very literal stuff of saying that cardinal signs are very good at initiating new things or getting things going, but they don't have a lot of staying power or follow through. That fixed signs have a hard time getting going, but they have good like endurance and longevity and sort of permanence.
Yeah, and people talk about Nate Diaz as a notoriously sleepy fighter. Mm-hmm. Like that's the term they use, that he doesn't wake up until, you know, until 30 strikes have been exchanged on each side.
Sure. And then mutable signs, just in terms of being like transitional or capable of doing two things at once, or sometimes initiating one thing, but not being able to bring it to completion until they initiate a second action, which then finishes before the first, so that it's sort of like digressive. I'm not sure what fighting style that would be.
Oh, well, there are a couple champions in MMA who have Mars and Pisces. Chuck Liddell, who was, I don't know, champion for half a decade, and Anderson Silva. And they were both devastating counter strikers, right? Mm-hmm. They would wait for the other person to initiate and then take their heads off.
So maybe like adaptability or something like that.
Right. Well, it's, you know, reaction, setting a trap, you know, it's adapting to what the other person is doing rather than, you know, Conor McGregor or Ronda Rousey, who are just going to run up to you and do their thing at you until you lose.
Sure. Yeah. Is it a kind of style, Austin, where they almost have to wait for the other person to make the first move or do something and then they respond to that?
Absolutely. That's what counter striking is.
Yeah.
Is like, oh, they're going to try to come in, you know, with this 1-2 and I've got this ready for them. And so when they do that, then I get to, then you drop a bomb on their head and they fall down.
Yeah.
Yeah. Counter striking is exactly that. The other person you set a trap and you wait for the person to throw the thing that you want them to throw. So then you can do your much more effective thing.
Right. Right. That's very much how I see the mutable signs working as a group, is that they'll take whatever someone else throws out there and adapt or change it. And I guess in fighting, then that's the counter striking that you get.
Yep. Yep.
That makes a lot of sense. All right. Well, yeah, that's a feel good Mars retrograde story compared to some of the other ones that you were mentioning earlier, which just for clarification, you were just mentioning in passing because they're super depressing, not because they're not.
Well, they're really relevant to describing this Mars retrograde in this particular period of history. I wish they weren't, but it is worth noting. Those are both, you know, those are both things that one of them concluded at the midpoint, right, with the Mars algol thing, and we're finding out it was worse than anybody said. And another thing started at that midpoint once Mars was direct. And we're watching that unfold in the Philippines, and many national and international observers are very concerned about that.
Right. All right. And so, and we're almost out of, we're just, I think, days now from, or have we just passed the shadow period? What degree did it station at 8 or 9?
Yeah, passed the shadow period.
Okay. Was it?
I think it was 8 degrees.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So we literally just came out in the past few days of the shadow period of Mars, but we're about to hit We're a day or so away from the last conjunction as we're recording this, because Mars is still at like 9 degrees, 35 minutes of Sagittarius, and Saturn's at 9:52. So, Austin, I know you wanted to record the show after the conjunction so that we could sort of like recap the sort of aftermath, but it sort of worked out that we had to do it today. So we'll have to follow up on that next month.
Well, so let's talk a little bit about how Mars-Saturn feels right now. Maybe not 20 minutes worth, but I just want to say it's in my sixth, and I've been having otherwise inexplicable pains in my hip and my lower back, and I never have. I have very flexible, well-lubricated hips. I don't have hip issues, and I don't have lower back issues, but I've had like Mars-Saturn like right in the Sag place in the body. And I was sort of like, oh, of course. And of course, I'm like having some weird nerve pain there, which I never have. And I guarantee you will be done in like 4 days.
Right. And you've been having some stuff too, right, Kelly?
Oh, yeah. I mean, as Austin said, we don't necessarily need to talk about it for 20 minutes. But it's the Saturn-Mars conjunction at 9 Sag is directly hitting my moon. And by square, my Pisces moon. And I've had a host of sort of digestive tummy things, I guess, not to gross anyone out, that have happened over the last few weeks while this has been building, while the Mars part's been building, but of course the Saturn part's been in play since late July. And just recently I went to have some acupuncture, and the Chinese medicine guy was saying that my liver is very sluggish or sleepy. Which I thought was quite funny given the Saturn-Sag combination with Jupiter and at Sag, I guess, certainly Jupiter connected to the liver. So it's really interesting how both Austin and I had some physical manifestations of this influence. Have you noticed anything, Chris, at all?
Yeah, I mean, I noticed a few days ago or maybe half a week ago that Adam Ellenboss actually had a really good delineation for one of his daily or weekly horoscopes that I resonated with at the time, where he said, he was talking about the Mars-Saturn conjunction. He says, the keywords he was using, he wrote out, he said, Mars-Saturn, discipline, focus, maturity, strength, and commitment. But then he pointed out that it's the Mars-Saturn conjunction is square to Neptune. And so he said the sort of phrase or keyword for this was the illusion or appearance of discipline, focus, maturity, strength, and commitment, and how easily it slips away or becomes something else due to the square from Neptune. Anyway, the physical thing I had this month was just getting this weird, mysterious cold that sort of took all of my like energy and focus and everything that I had for a couple of weeks and, you know, reduced me to watching Netflix for a little while, when trying to read or like fill in footnotes when I could. And Lisa and I are still recovering from that after a couple of weeks, but, yeah, it's weird seeing that happen in different ways for different people, depending on where it fell in the chart.
Mm.
So, yeah, so that's the Mars-Saturn conjunction. And obviously, that's about to go exact, and it's still playing out for people. And then really, on some level, I don't feel, even though Mars has come out of its retrograde period, it's going to conjoin Saturn in the next few days, sort of having the final conjunction. I don't feel like all of that's going to be fully over until Mars ingresses into Capricorn and just gets out of Sagittarius completely, because its whole presence there and its whole sort of flirtation with Saturn all year, off and on at different points, has really been a large part of this. And it seems like we're not going to be fully free of that until Mars and Saturn have fully moved out of the same sign and are sort of, you know, not living in the same house together, so to speak.
Yeah. And that's something that happens at the end of this September. That's something to look forward to for people.
Yeah. So that's going to take place. So Mars leaves Sagittarius and ingresses into Capricorn finally on September 27th, it looks like.
Yes.
So especially for people, I would say that, you know, where they're getting hit particularly hard by this Mars-Saturn conjunction, you know, if they have stuff that's closely configured to that by degree, this might be the most intense point, but some of the events and circumstances surrounding that might not be fully wrapped up until Mars completely departs from this sign at the end of September.
Yeah, there'll still be some of that ambient Mars-Saturn tension and drive.
Sure. So other than that, sort of backing up a little bit, we've got a really major thing that I know you guys have been looking forward to, because we've been mentioning it for like a few months now, that starts right at the top of the month on the 1st of September, right?
The eclipse?
Yeah, the little minor minor eclipse thing. I think we've talked about a few times in the past. So that's taking place. That's a new moon / solar eclipse taking place on September 1st in Virgo, right?
Yep.
Correct. Yes.
Okay.
9 degrees Virgo, and the sun and moon, or the new moon, I guess, will only be 3 degrees away from the nodes, the north nodes at 12 Virgo, which is the closer the new or the full moon itself is to the nodes, the more dramatic or intense an eclipse we're going to experience, the more total, I guess.
I believe it is officially a total eclipse.
I think you're correct, Austin.
Yeah, there, after our last podcast a month ago, it's been funny seeing this whole debate happening in the astrological community and like lots of astrologers writing about whether or not that lunar eclipse that just happened in Aquarius was an eclipse or not, which you two, I think.
You mean the full moon?
Yeah.
The full moon in the Aquarius full moon.
The full moon / almost lunar eclipse that took place a couple of weeks ago, because it was just barely, like what, they said 3% or something was eclipsed.
Yes. And everybody
but,
knows.
But only with penumbra, not even with proper shadow.
Okay.
Like the shadow of the shadow.
Exactly.
Do you guys feel, after observing that and everything, do you guys feel vindicated? There was no second thoughts or anything?
So I'm pretty sensitive to eclipses. The inner landscape that I get changes a lot around eclipses. And there is sort of a note. There's like a moat of eclipsy darkness. Looking at what actually happened for people, it doesn't seem eclipsy in the slightest. But I do think there was just like this little note, which is it's almost just like a little like a 15-second teaser trailer for what happens during the proper eclipses in September.
Right. That was my feeling. I mean, I felt like there was something there, but I wanted to wait and see, you know, what happened. And I don't know. It certainly wasn't the monumental event, I think, that these eclipses in September are going to be, especially for people that have them falling in critical parts of their chart. But it was a little bit more than a normal.
Well, full moon, the eclipse, the 1st of September eclipse, is kind of vibing the same part of the sky, just in terms of degrees, that the Saturn Neptune square. So around that 9, 10, 11, 12 of the mutable signs.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Right. That's really good. So if you're already being triggered, well, just hold on to your hats, people.
Sure. So
more
to come. Going to be a follow up here.
Yeah. I mean, so really, like, so the eclipse happens at 9, and then Saturn and Neptune are at 10. So
yes.
This is a righteous T square. This is not like off by 5 degrees or 10
degrees.
No,
this is a total proper.
And so what's in one way that I look at this is that, you know, earlier in August, we had first Mercury made that Saturn Neptune T square, and then Venus made that Saturn Neptune T square. And now not only the sun, but the sun and the moon at the same time in a significant configuration, an eclipse, which is going to be so total that it's annular, is right there. And so the new moon really, whenever you have a new moon or a full moon, they speak not only to that night, but at least the coming 2 weeks until the next lunation. And so there's a seed buried by each lunation that takes a little while to fully sprout. Although sometimes you have a rather dramatic day or night. And what's interesting to me about that is that September holds the very last perfect square between Saturn and Neptune. Right. And so we're getting this new moon just staring directly at that, at both sides of that right before they have their final clash. And so this speaks of climax and resolution to me. I was thinking about like, you know, what do the sun and moon in Virgo think about this whole Saturn Neptune thing? Because Saturn Neptune thing is like this kind of argument over what's real and what's fake. Right. Do we open up? Do we wall up? You know, what's real, what's fake, et cetera, et cetera. And I can see the sun and moon in Virgo being like, you're both full of shit. Right. You know, it's like, it's bringing that Virgoan particularity and focus to what's, you know, a set of debates that have, you know, in many ways spun out of control in both directions. And so I think it's actually going to kind of walk it towards clarity.
That's a really great point, Austin. I mean, the thing that also comes to mind listening to you describe that is the Saturn in Sag and the Neptune in Pisces are both Jupiter ruled signs. So they're both kind of dabbling in maybe larger conceptual kind of ideas and concepts. And this emphasis now in Virgo is much more about specifics or practicalities or even sort of useful outcomes that can be immediately or easily applied to daily life and mundane matters.
Yeah,
and
or so, facts even.
Facts, yes. Even like, okay, this is a great idea, but there is nothing to substantiate this.
Well, and what I think ties into that is, and the very right before the end of August, we have Mercury stationing retrograde in Virgo. And mm-hmm. so Mercury is fresh off his retrograde station on this eclipse. And Mercury stations retrograde at the end of Virgo, basically right on top of Jupiter.
Yes.
Right? And so Jupiter is ruling both Sag and Pisces and therefore affecting what Saturn and Neptune are doing. Mercury as Jupiter's ruler, right? Because Mercury is proper in Virgo, says, okay, so we're going to do some rethinking about this. We're going to strip away the layer, you know, we're going to try to strip away some of the layers of rhetoric and get back down to what's actually going on here.
Yes, to get underneath it or inside it.
Yeah.
And the two big words that I've been dabbling with for September as well, which relate to some of the things you were saying, Austin, is this idea of finales and then transition, because whole Saturn-Neptune process, which started in November of 2015, that is concluding. And the other thing that's concluding in September is the Jupiter and Virgo period.
Yeah.
Because of course, the big news of September is that on the 9th, Jupiter is moving into Libra, out of the sign of its detriment, into an air sign, into a cardinal sign, major, major change in terms of quality coming through. So that's super exciting.
Well, and we have with that, because Venus moves into Libra at the moved into Libra at the very end of August.
Yes.
We have this nice period where we have both Jupiter and Venus in Libra, which I think will lubricate some gears that might have otherwise ground and help, you know, bring some harmony and balance to what is a month with a lot of big transitions, a lot of big climaxes and transitions. But we've got help here. You know, there's ointment for the burns and chafing.
Yes. Yeah. It is. It's such a shift, isn't it, to come out of this very kind of dry, prickly August period into, I mean, I always think of Venus in Libra as like cosmic honey. It's sweet and kind, and it's not going to fix everything, but it's going to add a dash of sweetness, or, you know, the chocolate ice cream at the end of a hard day that just makes you feel better about everything.
Yeah, and with Jupiter in Libra, I find that Jupiter in Libra is very, tends to be conciliatory.
Yes.
It's sort of like, you know, Jupiter is sort of like, what is wisdom? And so Jupiter in Virgo says, wisdom is doing all of your homework. And, you know, you ask Jupiter in Libra, what is wisdom? And Jupiter in Libra says, well, it's getting along with people and listening to other people's perspectives and, you know, trying to stay away from the extremes.
Yes, it is. And I think that's, I was researching, because I did record this Jupiter and Libra thing today, about one of the ideas around benefics is that they tend to create some balance. And what I think is really interesting is we've got the big benefic Jupiter in the sign of the little benefic Venus. And I think you're really hitting on something there, Austin, the idea of some more moderate or temperate middle ground or conciliatory way forward. I think we're likely to see more of that energy, or people experience that personally, certainly with Jupiter in Libra. But as you mentioned, we really have a double whammy in September, which is nothing to be disappointed about.
Yeah. You know, so my hope, and I think I've discussed this with both of you privately, is that when with Jupiter's time in Libra, with it ruling Saturn and Sag, it'll be people getting tired of being so polarized, just getting so tired of it. and, you know, coming exhausted a little closer to center or yes. a little closer to compromise.
Yes. Yeah. Like there's no more fight anymore.
What does Leonard Cohen say? Everyone will love to come. Everyone to love will come, not like a something, but like a refugee.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Right. Eventually we get tired and we have to come back to like talking to other people, even though they're wrong.
Well, even though they're wrong. I do think that idea of interacting with others is a huge part of the Jupiter and Libra process. Jupiter is primarily a sanguine or an air type planet, and it is moving into an air sign, which has, you know, that humane quality, very much about, it's not just, you know, Jupiter and Virgo is like the apprentice or the master working solo in their studio. Jupiter and Libra is more about reaching out and connecting with people, either in real life or through social media and other online platforms.
Both probably.
Probably a bit of both, yeah.
Right. That actually reminds me, I just remembered now that we're an hour into this, that two of my elections this month actually feature that Venus-Jupiter conjunction or sign-based conjunction or co-presence.
Actually, hold on. Let me just I looked up the quote. The actual quote from Leonard Cohen's song is, every heart to love will come, but like a refugee.
Anyway. Oh, beautiful.
Nice. So I'll skip over the first election, but the one that really features that Venus-Jupiter thing conjunction prominently takes place on September 13th at about 7:30 in the morning with early Libra rising. Like, let's say, just like the first degree of Libra rising, because this is not too long after Jupiter's ingressed into Libra, only in the second week of September. So the chart features Libra rising with Jupiter in Libra in the first house, conjunct the ascendant in a day chart, because the sun rose just a little bit before this. Venus is also in Libra at 17 degrees of Libra in the first house, ruling the ascendant. Relatively well-placed. It is separating from a square with Pluto, which, you know, that's the downside. And we've been dealing with this for a few years now, which is basically any time you have an election that features cardinal planets or any time you have something good, like putting Venus in Libra, you still have to contend with dealing with, you know, Pluto going through Capricorn and Uranus going through Aries. But nonetheless, all those things aside, Venus is extremely well-placed in the first house in its own sign, co-present with Jupiter, separating from a square with Pluto. It's applying to a sextile with Mars and Sagittarius in the third house, and I believe that's its next aspect that it applies to, followed by an opposition eventually about 6 degrees away with Uranus in the seventh in Aries. And the moon is in Aquarius in the fifth whole sign house at 8 degrees of Aquarius, looks to be applying to a sextile with reception with Saturn, followed eventually by a trine with Venus. So the moon's actually getting a nice little two trines from both of the benefics, from Jupiter and Venus. And if not for Saturn sort of interfering there, would be fully enclosed by the rays of both benefics. So this would be a great chart for those of you that are trying to emphasize that Venus-Jupiter conjunction and some of the favorable things associated with it. It has a lot of emphasis on air signs because the ruler of the ascendant's in an air sign and the moon's in an air sign. The lot of fortune, for that matter, is also in Aquarius in an air sign. So definitely using it for things like that in terms of, there's the conciliatory sort of aspect of it due to Venus being so prominent and due to Libra being so strong, like you were saying earlier, I think, Austin. But then there's also a sort of intellectual side of it as well, due to the emphasis on air signs that would be good to use or to take advantage of as well. So that's my first chart. What do you guys think?
I like double benefics.
Yes.
Yeah, double benefics are usually good. And there's a similar one, actually, just about a week later. This is the other one. It's actually the last time you can really grab Venus before it departs. It's just getting ready to leave Libra. But if you want to use that one more time, There's one more election on September 23rd at about 7:05 in the morning. And this one, again, has early Libra rising with Jupiter on the ascendant at 3 degrees of Libra. And the sun has just ingressed into Libra, so it will be in the first house applying to a conjunction with Jupiter. And Venus is at the very end of the sign at 29 degrees of Libra, getting ready to leave that sign and move into Scorpio, but it's still barely got the last of that dignity in Libra in the first whole sign house. And the moon is actually up in Cancer in the 10th house, 2 degrees of Cancer applying to a square with Jupiter. So very similar chart, but in this one, the sun is now in Libra and the moon is up in Cancer in the 10th instead of Aquarius. So it gives it a little bit more water, a little bit more of a balance between water signs and air signs compared to the previous chart. So those are probably the two best elections this month, because those are the two that actually take advantage or take full advantage of, having both benefics in the same sign. The only other one that kind of takes advantage of that takes place on September 3rd at about 2:30 in the morning, if you want to stay up super late. And this one has Cancer rising and the moon in Libra in the fourth whole sign house applying to a conjunction with Venus at 5 degrees of Libra, also in the fourth house. So again, it's taking advantage of that very strong, dignified Venus placement, especially in this instance, by putting it in a night chart and making it even more positive by making sure that the ruler of the ascendant is applying to it. So those are the three best charts this month that I'd recommend.
Yeah, those are good. I would just add for things which require less lasting elections, right? Like not like a marriage, but if like, you know, you kind of want to do something this week, Venus and Libra Fridays are going to tend to be nice.
Of course.
You know, like it, one really simple, but you know, probably 80% effective, quick and dirty electional is, hey, if there's a planet, especially if it's a benefic and it's unafflicted and it's got good dignity, do stuff on its day. And if you can, do it on the hour.
Sure. You know,
so Venus and Libra Fridays at about 2 to 3 where I am, good times.
And that's because Friday is Venus's day.
Right. The planetary days and hours are basically a Time Lord system for reality, rather than a Time Lord system for a given nativity. And so planets get to have their say at these particular times. And it's easier to draw on whatever they're dishing out.
That's a good way to conceptualize it. I like that, like a universal Time Lord system. Yep. Or a mundane Time Lord system.
Yeah. And it's so easy to learn. Simple, you know, like you don't have to be great at astrology. Just remember those seven, that order. And half of the days are coded into that, like Sunday, Saturn day. And you're like, okay, which planet is good? I remember noticing this, like, God, maybe this is 9 years ago. There was this, there was a Mars retrograde happening. And I was working with mentally ill youth. And I had a very martial client, and it was always Mars retrograde Tuesdays were always the worst. It's like, oh yeah. And I'm probably legally not allowed to talk about what would happen on Mars retrograde Tuesdays. But let's just say that that was one of the things that brought me to consider planetary hours seriously. I was like, oh no, it's Tuesday.
So for September, it's going to be really interesting for people to watch Wednesdays with the Mercury in Virgo, but also retrograde.
Retrograde Wednesdays are a thing.
Yeah.
Right. So that's happening. So it's in its shadow for a while in September, but it actually, or no, I'm sorry. No. It's stationary.
It's retrograde.
It's retrograde, yeah, for the entirety of
September. Yeah, it's retro on August 30th.
Until like the 22nd or something of September.
Yeah, I believe that's the case.
Yeah, stations direct in Virgo on the 22nd of September at what degree?
About 14.
14. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
So that'll be interesting. We're dealing with a Mercury retrograde in Virgo all of September, essentially.
Yes.
Well, for all of Virgo time.
For all of Virgo time. That is true. And just what you were saying there, Austin, the idea of the very simple elections, Wednesdays being Mercury Day and Mercury being retro. So take care.
Yeah. So let's talk about the Mercury retrograde a little bit. So here's a couple thoughts I have. One, I think it's really interesting that Mercury stations retrograde on top of Jupiter, which it rules. And so it actually conjoined Jupiter on the 21st of August. And then it goes just a little bit past Jupiter and it's like, retrograde. And then comes back and conjoins Jupiter again on, I believe, the 2nd of September. And then they part ways, right? Jupiter moves into Libra. Mercury goes back to 14, but then they meet up again in October. And it's almost like Mercury helping Jupiter finish up the Jupiter and Virgo business. I've been thinking about it in terms of, I wrote about it this week, in terms of like taking a look at one final, and that's me, my bad. Taking a look at it. See, we're talking about Mercury retrograde.
Of course.
These things happen. You invoke the names and the actions follow. But I've been thinking about, you know, I know a lot of astrologers, including myself, have been like, oh, poo-poo, Jupiter can't do anything in Virgo. But when I look back at the last year, I've done some very successful Virgo work in my third, like I started writing a column again. And so I feel like Mercury retrograde is like, okay, Jupiter, you've been trying to do this all year. You've been trying to, I don't know, you know, quit drinking 100 beers every night, or you've been, you know, trying to make your column writing process more efficient, or you've been, you know, whatever the sort of, if the more is less or the less is more Jupiter and Virgo thing you've been working on. I feel like Mercury, you know, starting like, you know, taking that energy of Jupiter and being really good at it, 'cause it's in Virgo. It's like helping, it's going to help people install that final upgrade or finally get that thing that they've been meaning to do all year, that, you know, do that little rearrangement. And then Mercury, will come back and make a third conjunction to Jupiter when it's solidly in Libra. And so I feel like Mercury's kind of walking Jupiter over, helping him finish up here. And then it's going to they're going to meet up on the other side in Libra.
That's perfect. I like that, especially because it stations at the very end of, you know, later in September on the 22nd, conjunct the North Node at 12 degrees of Virgo. So that's a nice sort of magnifying final station right there. That almost blows that up even more than it might be otherwise.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And another, just the other thing I have, my other like hit on Mercury retrograde in Virgo is I feel like in terms of landscapes we might be exploring, I feel like it's getting lost in the library, like just going down a research hole, in maybe a good way. But, you know, for me, I had this sort of image of like, you know, you're like digging for facts and whatnot. And then suddenly, you know, you're in some massive cavernous underground complex surrounded by millions of books. And it's glorious, but, you know, you kind of have to go down a tunnel. And the pathway through that isn't necessarily going to be where it is. The pathway through that isn't going to be linear, right? You do that sort of that research synchronicity confusion spiral.
I like that. That's basically my life right now for this summer. I have developed what I call a book moat, which is, you know, when you're trying to cite like 20 or 30 different books, or you're reading through them for some specific research project, but then you leave them open sort of face down to the page that that you need to cite later. And then you build up this sort of collection of books in a 360 degree circle around you until at some point you have to put them away.
Oh yeah. That's right. My favorite part of editing and proofing an article is the book piles all opened at essential pages for referencing.
Right. You're at the center of the vortex, the Uzumaki.
Right. It's a very complicated system, but it works out.
Like all creative systems, it can be complicated, but brilliant.
Sure. And this is actually going back to the eclipse, but also Mercury stationing on top of that node. It was something that was interesting as I was trying to write this out and explain what the node was in the book this month, that's kind of interesting that I don't think people usually understand, is there's like a very simple way to explain what the moon's nodes are. And it's that the sun, if you follow the sun and the path that the planets take through the sky, over a long period of time, like over a succession of days or over a succession of weeks or months, you see that the sun and the rest of the planets all move through. They don't go all, like, all over the sky, but instead they walk over a very specific predefined path through the sky, and let's say through the backdrop of the constellations. And that path that the sun and moon and other planets always follow is the ecliptic, and that's essentially the zodiac, or that's what the zodiac comes from, is this path that the planets move through in the sky over a yearly basis. But the moon is unique because it does go along that same path more or less, but instead of staying on sort of strictly on the path, it moves above the path and below the path periodically. And what the nodes are essentially is just literally the point where the moon's path intersects the path of the sun. Because when that happens, then that's where eclipses take place. So the north node, or the ascending node — it was called the ascending node actually traditionally, they didn't start calling it the north node until later. Originally it was called the ascending node — is the point where the moon's path moves from being sort of southern to being northern, whereas the south node is the point where the moon moves from being sort of at the top of its path to going below the sun's path. Does that make sense, or am I explaining that correctly?
Sure. They're like dusk and dawn. You know, after it hits the north node, it begins to be above the sun. And once it hits the south node, it goes below the sun.
Right.
From our point of view.
To the extent that the sun's path is like a, if you conceptualize it as like a horizontal line or something like that.
Yeah. And the moon could be said to be doing like a sine wave above and below that. And the two points where the sine wave intersects the horizontal line are the nodes. And the bendings of the nodes are the top and bottom of that sine wave.
Okay, right. That's a really good point, because that's interesting, because I didn't realize that doctrine of referring to them to the bendings goes back so far, but I actually found it referenced in Ptolemy in the second century recently, mm-hmm. So it actually goes back really far.
Yeah, it's sort of like noon and midnight, if the nodes themselves are like dusk and dawn.
Mm, interesting.
But yeah, and so I'm going to plug myself here. I taught a really good month-long class on the nodes last time we had eclipses in March, and that is now available for sale. It's been edited. It's been edited, and the audio has been cleaned up, and so people can check that out if they want to think about and learn about nodes and eclipses over this next month.
Excellent. And you deal with you have slides and everything, visuals?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's lots. It's, you know, it's like 7-8 hours of let's talk about nodes, and let's talk about what they do, and let's talk about eclipses, and let's talk about them in a natal context, let's talk about them in a, you know, what reality is like outside of your one experience context.
Excellent. Well, so I thought that was a really interesting thing, just because I don't think people actually usually understand what the nodes are or what they represent necessarily astronomically. So it's interesting trying to find a way to like explain that in simple language or simple visuals. Sort of broadly connected with that, actually, an astrologer that wrote a famous book on the nodes, Jan Spiller, just passed away just a few weeks ago, right? Had you guys heard that?
Yeah, I think I had read a few things on Facebook about it.
Okay.
Sorry.
No, go ahead.
Oh, well, I didn't want to interrupt the eulogy. I didn't know Jan. I didn't read her work, so I can't speak to that. But I didn't want to just jump ahead if you guys had stuff to say.
No, I just wanted to mention it briefly as being relevant in terms of, I mean, I didn't know her very well. Didn't know her well either. I just know that was one of the books that I read at some point early on when I was trying to understand what the nodes were. And while I haven't written in a number of years, it's kind of... Yeah, notable that she passed away, and she was a notable astrologer.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, so, and that book, Astrology for the Soul, I think is the one you're talking about, Chris. It's not super technical, so for people that might be looking for a bit of an introduction to the ideas or concepts that might be attached to the nodes, I remember reading it very early too and finding it good for being at that stage.
Sure, just in terms of, of delineations of that.
Really juicy delineations, I guess, you know. Anyway, Austin, were you going to say something?
Oh, well, so on the topic of nodes, how about that lunar eclipse on the 16th?
Totally.
It would be 17th in your time zone, Chris, but it's Friday night.
Right.
Yes. Yeah. And the other point, because we are talking about the nodes and eclipses and such, when we have an eclipse season, it's like a station period for the nodes, which means that the nodes are spending a lot of time at this 12-degree Pisces Virgo axis the entire month of September and about half of the month of October. So just to kind of highlight, that's what's happening behind the eclipses, I guess, for people who might be interested in diving into the nodes since we have.
That's a nice point. And I guess in addition to that, if you are in a year or a time period that particularly emphasizes the sun or the moon, such as a sun ruled perfection or a moon ruled perfection, then the eclipses get another exclamation point.
Yes. Yeah. They become the things to watch for, like the transits, I guess.
Right.
Yeah. They will tend to stand far out from the busy crowd of planets if you're in a sun year and there's a solar eclipse.
Yeah, that's huge. If you're in a Cancer or a Leo perfection year.
Which I am.
Which one are you in again?
I mean a Leo perfection. And I actually had a solar eclipse like 3 days after I went into that Leo perfection. Therefore three degrees off my sun in March, which was very interesting.
Nice.
So the lunar eclipse, Austin, you want to talk about?
So
early Saturday morning for our Aussie listeners.
Right. It's at 24 Virgo Pisces, right? The sun is at 24 Virgo. The moon is going to be eclipsed at 24 degrees Pisces. And this is a partial or a penumbral? It'll be visible. Check. It's not super duper strong. It's actually pretty weak, but it will at least be, you know, it will be visibly eclipsed.
It will be visible.
You can look up and be like, oh, somebody smeared blood on that part of the moon.
So it's like 12 degrees. So the eclipse takes place at 24 Pisces. So it's about, and the nodes are at 12 degrees of Virgo and Pisces at that point. So it's like 12 degrees off the nodes.
Yeah, I think that's a penumbral. Kelly, are you checking?
Well, I was just looking in the ephemeris, but I've got a juicy A there. So that usually says annular, doesn't it?
Well, you can't have an annular unless it's solar.
Well, that's what I was confused about.
You're using the American ephemeris or what?
Your ephemeris is fired.
Yeah, well, that's...
It's a penumbral.
Yeah, okay.
All right.
So where did you check that, Austin?
There are a bunch of great websites that give you all the information. You can actually, Wikipedia has a separate entry for every eclipse.
Okay.
And you can go to NASA. There's a bunch of great sites that give it to you. They give you like where it's going to be visible. Like if you just Google, you know, a lunar eclipse, September 16th, 2016, you'll get like 10 great results.
Oh yeah. And the NASA website's really good too.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, by the way, NASA didn't think that last full moon was an eclipse.
So we're on NASA's side.
That's there right.
We go. All right. Well,
us and the materialists.
Yeah. NASA doesn't think highly.
That's awesome. Oh, gosh.
All right.
Anyway.
So related to eclipses, because I meant to mention this earlier, I just saw this awesome video, and I'll post a link in the podcast description, but it shows that in 1 year, on August 21st, 2017, there's a total solar eclipse that'll stretch across the entire width of the United States.
Oh, yeah. If you want to talk about eclipses, let's talk about the eclipses of 2017.
Yeah, there's some.
We should. This is really supposed to be a monthly show.
I know. But Chris is prefacing it. Honestly, the eclipses in August of 2017 are off the charts.
So it's a year from now, almost exactly a year from now when we're recording this on the 23rd. So I just wanted to mention it because I'm sure we'll talk about this a million times in the future, but we've got some wild eclipses coming up, and I'll post that video for people that want to check it out because it's really cool because it starts like off the West Coast and it goes through like Salem, Oregon, and then it just goes all the way through the entire continental United States through a bunch of states, sort of crossing through the middle through other states like Wyoming and Omaha, Nebraska, St. Louis, Nashville, Athens, Georgia, and then ends somewhere around like Charleston. But I just thought that was really wide, and I'm sure it has a bunch of mundane implications that we'll have to.
That'll also be when the nodes are in the same sign that the United States has them in. It'll be the Leo Aquarius eclipses, or
yes,
at least nodes, yes, there, which is what the U.S. had.
Wow. Okay. So we've got some wild stuff coming up.
The eclipses are actually in the signs of Leo and Aquarius too. So.
Oh, right, because the nodes are getting ready to retrograde out of Virgo Pisces and move into Leo Aquarius, yes, so that we starting early next year, we officially start the whole Aquarius-Leo eclipse season for a couple of years.
Yes.
Well, for 18-ish months.
For 18 months, yeah. The 1st of September eclipse in Virgo is actually the last Virgo eclipse,
mm-hmm,
in this,
mm-hmm,
period.
Interesting. So that's, yeah, that's also finishing or sort of completing a, let's say, almost like 2-year period then here.
Yes.
So,
yeah, so again, those themes
people,
of conclusion.
So people might want to look. So there was a nice solar in Virgo last September. And so you might want to think about what you started then, or what, if you maybe picked a different direction or got an idea that maybe you wanted to do things differently in a particular area last September. And then kind of look at where that's at right now, where that's come to, because there'll probably be some connection between this month's solar and last year's solar in Virgo.
So this is going to be the last Virgo solar eclipse. Then we'll have a lunar eclipse in Pisces early next year. And is that the last?
No, lunar eclipse this month.
Is in Pisces, and then we have a solar eclipse in Pisces next February.
Oh, it's, yeah, a solar eclipse.
But then the lunar will be in Leo.
In Leo, yes.
Gotcha. All right. Well.
But so this lunar eclipse, right,
yes,
24, it's also T-squaring Mars within a degree. Mars, I think this is like Mars and Sag's
last hurrah.
Yeah, it's the last hurrah, right, because it's a tight T-square, and Mars is actually applying to and completing a trine with Uranus and Aries at exactly the same time. So, usually with these, like, these Pisces Virgo eclipses, you have this sort of like, you sort of have the machine and the ghost that haunts it, right? The facts and then their meaning, right? The physical reality of your life and the dream that encloses it. These are the kind of themes you get. But this one has a bunch of Mars in there, right? And so these themes, this sort of like subtle and gross as they intersect with each other, are heated up. And it's sort of like, okay, what are you going to do with that? How are you going to get something done? How are you going to make a change, right? It's Mars, Uranus, and fire signs. And so they get to kind of intrude on this. Or maybe we could just say direct these musings at the accomplishment of particular outcomes, rather than being more yin and contemplative.
Definitely. So towards the end of the month, we've got sort of rapid fire. We got Sun ingressing into Libra September 22nd, of course, Venus into Scorpio September 23rd, completing the Venus and Libra period. Quasi big one, Pluto stationing direct in September, which might be relevant to whatever extent it's hitting other cardinal planets still at that point. And interestingly, a day after that, immediately right after that, Mars ingresses into Capricorn September 27th. And then finally, we end the month with a new moon in Libra on September 30th. And since that's the second new moon in September, I believe that counts as a blue moon, right? Isn't that the definition of a blue moon? That it's like
two? I think,
well,
it is.
A blue moon, I think, traditionally is full moon because you can't see.
Oh, you're right.
New, okay, moons. I just think,
oh,
from,
yeah,
well, what's the
from
opposite
a farmer's almanac.
Like a green
But I mean,
moon.
That's been happening a lot this year because that's where the lunar cycle is. Right. We actually had we had an astrological blue moon in Sagittarius. From the end of May to the, middle end of June, right, where we had two full moons in Sagittarius. I don't think this is terribly significant. They're in different signs.
I am looking up what that's called. I think it might be called a No,
I've kind of tried to avoid the whole blue moon thing. Right. Just it seems to be a little bit arbitrary in terms of two lunar events happening in one calendar month.
Yeah, right. I think if they're in the same solar month, then that's a big deal. I don't care if, you know, it's January or August or whatever.
Yeah, like there's not a lot of meaning philosophically or esoterically, I guess, so to speak, to the calendar months per se. So I tend to kind of not really focus that much on blue moon type things.
What we can say is that is a nice looking new moon. I want to get there. It's a new moon in Libra conjunct Jupiter.
Oh, yeah.
Give me some.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Okay, so it's at 8 degrees, I believe, of Libra, and Jupiter's at 4 degrees of Libra by that point. That's not bad.
I'm just going to pull up the chart.
I mean, no, it's not completely clear because Mars has just ingressed into Capricorn, so we've got it squaring Mars within a few degrees, so it's not the cleanest sort of lineup in Libra as it could be, but it's still pretty good.
But it is separating from the Mars. So the right. days leading up to the new moon could be a little hairy with those squares to Mars, certainly with Jupiter squaring Mars, or Mars squaring Jupiter, I should say. But yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, I'll take it.
It'll be nicer than the eclipses just in terms of less drama, I guess.
Yeah, in terms of general stability and balance. You know, that's one thing about the eclipses and about the symbolism of the nodes, no matter pretty much who you ask, is they tend, the nodes pull the luminaries and any other planets they hit towards extremes. They're the opposite of a balancing influence. You know, they pull things way one way and way the other way. And, some very interesting readjustments happen when things get pulled. Pushed and pulled so fiercely, but they're not good for they don't give you balance. They might force you to think about balance because of their extreme pulls in either direction. But if we're talking about a new moon in Libra conjunct Jupiter, which is the first lunation after a pair of eclipses, that's a nice return to balance. You know, the planets will actually help you, get your balance back rather than challenging you to keep your balance.
Definitely. That sounds good. Let me see. I sort of broadly connected with that. The very last election I have for September, it's a little iffy, but it's all right. It's September 28th at 11:35 p.m. with Cancer rising. Moon in Virgo applying to conjunction with Mercury in Virgo, which is now direct. So this election is much more grounded and much more earthy and much more focused on Virgo than some of the elections from earlier in the month that are much more focused on some of those Libra placements and like Venus and Jupiter in Libra. This one's a little bit more focused on, you know, practical details and writing and communication and doing the final end of that cleanup phase that Austin mentioned earlier in terms of Virgo, Mercury having that last retrograde phase in Virgo after Jupiter has left that sign. So that's the final one that I would recommend for the month. Are there any other major alignments? I mean, I think we covered pretty much everything, didn't we?
Yeah.
Well, I think the biggest stuff in September is more the sign changes and the eclipses plus the Saturn Neptune. But what do you think, Austin?
Yeah, I mean, just to list it, right? Eclipses, Mercury retrograde in its own sign, right? Mercury retrogrades in Virgo and Gemini, which Mercury rules, generally tend to be bigger rearrangements. Jupiter changes signs. Mars finally leaves Sag, and we get the last Saturn-Neptune square. Like it's a bunch of, all right, this is the last of that. And of course, Mercury's retrograde in its own sign. There's a lot of, things are going to look very different at the end of September than they did at the beginning of September. Cause there's so many important players, changing places. It's like curtain, you know, it's curtain on a lot of, 2016 storylines. And I would say in some ways it's almost like the next year. Our next set of stories will start in October because I think this one's going to bring a lot of 2016 stories to an end.
Definitely. Well, that makes a lot of sense. All right. So one of the pieces of news I forgot to mention as we're wrapping up is, you know, one of the big things that's happening right now in the astrological community is they're finally getting the big United Astrology Conference together, and it's finally happening, and speaker selection is underway. So all of the organizations, starting yesterday, actually, the first votes went out by some of the sponsoring organizations, where they're doing a new thing now, where some of the speakers were picked if they had really high numbers at the last UAC, but for a large chunk of the speakers are actually being voted on by members of the sponsoring organization, so that they've sort of democratized the process this time. And there's some pros and cons about that. And there was some sort of grumbling about it, some of which is understandable, some of which is not. But I actually got my first, ballot yesterday from the AFA, which is one of the organizations that's voting first. And then you could actually, you know, vote on which speakers, you know, you'd like to see or whatever. And I actually had a better appreciation for what they're doing with that and what that involves and how different of a process that is, and some of the positive and sort of aspects of that. But anyways, I bring it up because, Kelly, I think you're organizing a track. So you are set and you'll be speaking at UAC, right?
Correct.
Okay. I don't know if I'm supposed to say, that's not like secret knowledge, right?
If it is, anymore. I'm going to blame you.
Okay. Just blame me and I can talk to them. But Austin and I, we're still working our way up the ladder, so we need to get voted in. So they're doing voting right now. If you happen to be a member of one of the sponsoring organizations and you want to see us give a talk at UAC, then you should probably vote for us. So
yes, and the different orgs are going to be voting, I think, sort of sequentially, or the voting process will take place over the next few weeks. So if you haven't got information already yet, you will be getting it as long as you're a current member from the different organizations.
Yeah, you've got to renew your membership or sign up or whatever you got to do to make sure you're a member. The AFA and I think ACVA are voting right now. So that's already begun. So it's probably too late if you haven't received a ballot. But if you're a member of the NCGR or ESAR or AFAN, apparently those, they're going to be sending out ballots sometimes in the next few weeks in order to vote on which speakers you'd like to see at that conference. So it's going to be a huge conference. It's the United Astrology Conference, which is happening in Chicago, I believe at the end of May of 2018. So it's still 2 years away, which is a little bit annoying because that means all of us have to send in speaker or send in lecture descriptions for like a lecture we're going to give two years from now, right now. Did you already have to do that, Kelly?
I did, yes. And yeah, it is. It's a long process because it's such a large scale conference. I mean, if we throw some numbers around, I remember thinking when I went to, UAC 2008 or UAC 2012, there must be like 1,000 astrologers that attend this conference. And
oh, it's the speakers, like 1,500 to
maybe 1,500. I mean, there's 200 people that will speak,
right,
across 15 different tracks, I think, with different topics. And you know, the UAC conference, I think, is more of a cross section. So there's going to be Vedic astrology represented and financial and esoteric and traditional. I mean, there is really, beg, borrow or steal if people are listening and thinking, oh, I don't know about conferences. I'm not sure if I can go. It's expensive. 2 years, save your money. It's totally going to change your life. You might even meet someone special there, like other astrologers have.
Right. You met your current husband at the last UAC.
I did meet my husband at UAC in 2008. So it can really be life-changing, I tell you. And I think that's where I first crossed paths with you in person too, Chris.
Well, so actually, we didn't really connect until 2012. I think you're a little bit, distracted at the 2008 conference. We didn't hang out as much.
Well, I was somewhat distracted, but I do remember seeing you. So that was very exciting too. Because of course your reputation preceded you, even all the way to Australia.
Right.
So you guys will be conducting your marketing campaigns for your voting, and people should vote for you.
Yeah, basically. I mean, they told us that that's what we're supposed to do. So that's what I'm doing. We're supposed to tell people if you want to vote for us, then do it. So it's kind of like a campaign. That's, on the one hand, that's actually part of the drawback, and that's part of the debate about this as a process, which is, most conferences, it's more of like a sort of dictatorial type system where you have a small, what are the organizing committee is, which is just like a few people from an astrological organization, and they pick out, you know, who is going to speak at the conference. And it's usually a mixture of like people that work for the organization. So they're sort of giving them speaking positions in exchange for the fact that they've done all this work for free for the org. So it's like a quid pro quo thing. I don't know if that's the correct phrase. Is that the correct phrase?
I think it might be.
Okay. So there's an element of that usually. And then there's another element of just, you know, this group of people trying to pick out who they think should get speaking positions because there'll be a draw or because they're doing good work or whatever. So there's this sort of subjective element to it. And that's typically the way things are done. This time they're trying something different by having, you know, a component of it or a large portion being voting. And of course, the downside then is, you know, voting sometimes ends up being like almost like a popularity contest. And there's something
not almost a popularity contest.
Yeah. So it's literally a popularity contest. And there's something a little bit lame and superficial about that to some extent. But on the other hand, from an organizational standpoint, I can see the benefit because then they know, you know, the people got voted in are people that have large followings of people that want to hear them speak. So they know that it's not just going to be like an empty room if they invite that person to speak at the conference, but that people actually show up. The other end of it that I liked, though, is just it's actually really unique and really new to have actually a voice or a say as a member of one of the organizations in that process. And that was the thing that struck me yesterday when I cast my ballot for the AFA vote, is it was just kind of new and interesting, even though it seems like so obvious and such a natural thing to have to some extent. It's actually kind of new in the astrological community. So I'd recommend people, you know, if you're a member of one of the astrological organizations, to do that and to like sort of give your vote or voice your whatever preference or opinion in the process and actually actively participate in the process, since it will make a difference. All right. So I don't think I need to promote that anymore. Is there anything else we needed to say related to that or related to other like conference things? We're all going to be at the ESAR conference in October, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Awesome.
And it's going to be great to be able to connect in person. That will be lovely.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. I already know a lot of podcast listeners are going to be there. That's the biggest conference event of the year. I just found out I'll be speaking at NORWAC next year in May.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah, so I'm looking forward to that. And I'm excited to be back there again, because that's always a really good conference.
And super fun.
Yeah, and I'm sure there'll be lots of other events between now and then. All right, so with that, I think we can wrap up for the day. Do you guys have any other parting words or other things you'd like to mention before we go?
Just enjoy September.
Definitely. Austin?
I don't know if Austin has anything.
Experience September.
Ah, there you go.
It will not be boring. It'll be really interesting.
Yeah.
And it's not going to be like interesting as code for awful.
No.
It's going to be really interesting. I think it's going to be.
You actually mean that, Austin.
Yeah. It's going to be like, there's going to be a lot of this and a lot of that. I wouldn't say, it's not like a stable and fortunate month. I would say it's unstable, but not necessarily disastrous. It's more like lots of really intense moves this way and that way. And I think that probably a lot of 2016 will make sense in a way that it didn't before by the time you get to the end of September.
Brilliant.
Perfect.
I love that. And that's a good note to sign off on. It's especially because it's connected to the earlier eclipse cycle that happened in like March, right?
Mm-hmm.
Totally.
Okay. So thinking back to things that were happening or starting or forming, and then at that time, sort of being brought to completion in some sense, at least in terms of this year, around this time. All right. Well, I think that brings us to the end of the show then. Of course, yeah, sponsor this month is me, basically. So I have to plug that really quickly. So for Patreon people on the $5 and $10 tier, again, the $5 prize is my Intro to Electional Astrology course, which has some awesome lectures that basically tells you all the steps that I take in order to pick an auspicious chart each month. So if you've ever looked at these charts that I'm sort of rambling off during these episodes and wondering why the hell I came to certain conclusions about the chart, then you should totally sign up for that course. where I have five long sort of lectures. I think it totals out like 15 hours of lectures or 20 or something like that, where I teach you the basic and advanced principles of electional astrology with lots of example charts. And then, of course, in the Hellenistic course, that's my big one, and that's the one that I'm trying to finish a 700-page book on right now. When you sign up for it, you get access to, I think it's over 90 hours of lecture material. So if you like listening to me on the podcast, but you'd like something more practical and much more technique-oriented, then you would love the Hellenistic astrology course, because it's just a ton of very practical techniques and tons of chart examples and demonstrations. And there's a private Facebook forum for members of the group where they talk and about the techniques and share charts and stuff like that. Whenever people sign up, the course I'm currently charging $400 for it, but every time a person signs up, the first thing I hear is, you know, oh my God, you have so much material in this course, you should be charging a lot more for it. So that's probably true. And at some point that will probably change because I've been periodically raising the price of the course over the past few years. But for now, it's still a pretty good deal if you sign up. And of course, anybody that does sign up, I'm basically putting all of that money into funding writing the book at this point. So that would be helpful for me just in terms of finishing off the book process and hopefully by the end of this upcoming Mercury retrograde period, having it all together finally. I liked some of Austin's comments about cleaning things up and bringing some of Jupiter and Virgo to completion. And that sort of resonated with me in terms of the book. So, all right, I think that'll be the last episode for September, unless, you know, the mood strikes me and we suddenly need to do like another podcast on something. But until then, I guess we'll check in again next time. So thanks, Austin and Kelly, for joining me.
Anytime.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Thanks, guys.
Awesome. Very quickly, what are your websites again?
I'm austincoppock.com. AUSTINCOPPOCK.com.
And what's yours?
Oh my gosh. KellySAstrology.com. And it's Kelly, KELLY.
Awesome. And mine, of course, is ChrisBrennanAstrologer.com. So thanks everyone for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.